Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Putin's ploy. The Kremlin orchestrates sham referenda that aim to force occupied parts of Ukraine to join Russia.
I am against the referendum. I think that my town and my region fully belong to Ukraine. This is all very hard, and I reckon that there is no place for Russians on our land.
Then, courting conspiracy. Former President Trump embraces the unfounded theories of the extremely far-right QAnon community, raising concerns about future political violence. And it's Friday. David Brooks and Karen Tumulty weigh in on President Biden's speech at the United Nations and the tenuous state of Republican politics. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. A sell-off swept Wall Street and the world as rising interest rates in the U.S. and many other countries are intensifying fears of a recession. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hit its low for the year, down 486 points to close at 29,590. The Nasdaq fell nearly 200 points. The S&P 500 lost 64. For the week, all three stock indexes were down 4 to 5%. Voting has begun in the Russian-occupied regions of Ukraine on whether to join Russia proper. Moscow went ahead with the referenda today despite Western opposition. The U.S. and others charge that the votes are illegitimate and preordained to go Russia's way. We'll get a detailed report after the news summary. Hurricane Fiona is closing in on Canada tonight after blowing past Bermuda, with driving rain and winds gusting to 100 miles an hour. The storm churned up rough seas and knocked out power as it passed to the west. Islanders had boarded up windows in advance. Fiona will begin lashing Canada's Atlantic provinces late tonight. Hurricane watches extend from Nova Scotia to Newfoundland. Meanwhile, 60% of Puerto Rico's homes and businesses spent another day with no electricity. Counter-protesters in Iran marched in support of the Islamic regime today. That followed growing unrest over a young woman's death in the custody of so-called morality police. Several thousand demonstrators turned out in Tehran, waving Iranian flags. They accused anti-government protesters of being guided by foreigners.
The protesters and rioters that took to the streets are not ordinary people. They are trained groups that have entered our country to destroy the ruling system. Definitely, we won't allow this to happen.
The government claimed that the counter-protests were spontaneous. A disaster at sea off of Syria grew even worse today. Officials in Lebanon and Syria raised the death toll to 77 in the sinking of a migrant boat. The victims were Lebanese, Palestinians, and Syrian refugees, likely bound for Europe. Syrian state TV showed survivors brought on shore and taken to hospitals. It is the deadliest incident yet in an exodus driven by Lebanon's economic collapse. Protests in Japan are intensifying against holding a state funeral for former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Hundreds of people rallied today in Tokyo, denouncing Abe, who was assassinated in July. His pro-military policies made him one of Japan's most divisive leaders since World War II. Abe was cremated after a private funeral 4 days after his death. And back in this country, in-person voting for the midterm elections has officially begun. People began turning out today at voting centers in Minnesota, South Dakota, Virginia, and Wyoming. In all, 46 states and the District of Columbia will offer the option of voting early in person this year. Still to come on the NewsHour, David Brooks and Karen Tumulty analyze the week's political news. A NASA engineer is recognized for his work overseeing the launch of the Webb telescope. A new movement seeks to make hiking trails more accessible. We examine the literary legacy of the late author Hilary Mantel, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we've reported, in an escalation of the war in Ukraine, Moscow today launched what the U.S. calls illegal votes, or referenda, in four regions of southern and eastern Ukraine that are currently occupied by Russia. Meanwhile, the U.N. said today that it has found new evidence of war crimes, and many Russians appear to be fleeing the country instead of signing up to a new military draft. Nick Schifrin reports.
In a city still scarred by Russian shelling, now looms the threat of Russian annexation. Mariupol residents lined up outside what the Russians call a polling station to fill out what the Russians call ballots. The question is, do you want to join Russia? The outcome is not in doubt. State TV showed scripted and staged celebrations and some retail politicking. But this is the reality of what the U.S. and allies today called a sham. A soldier precedes a poll worker carrying a box of ballots, the occupied literally voting at gunpoint. Russian-installed Donetsk governor Denis Pushilin portrayed the vote as self-determination and annexation inevitable.
The referendum is a historical milestone, not only because we are certain the result will be positive, but because this is a culmination of our common, difficult journey. We're returning home.
But these Ukrainians insist it's their home and call the Russians unwanted guests. These residents of Mykolaiv risked their lives today to protest the referendum. And those who escaped Russian occupation remain defiant.
I am against the referendum. I think that my town and my region fully belong to Ukraine. This is all very hard, and I reckon that there is no place for Russians on our land.
What the Russians are doing on Ukrainian land, today UN officials say they found preliminary evidence of Russian atrocities.
Based on the evidence gathered by the commission, it has concluded that war crimes have been committed in Ukraine.
Eric Mosse chairs a UN independent commission of inquiry on Ukraine. He briefed the UN's Human Rights Council in Geneva today.
Sexual violence, torture, and cruel and inhuman treatment. There are examples of cases where relatives were forced to witness the crimes. In the cases we have investigated, the age of victims of sexual and gender-based violence ranged from 4 to 82 years.
And now those that committed those atrocities will be joined by hundreds of thousands more as Russia mobilizes. Among the 300,000 additional forces it promises to deploy, these recruits, 3,500 miles east of the Ukraine border. Some use sunglasses to hide tears.
The most difficult thing is to say goodbye to the kids and the rest.
And others are reluctant to head off to war and unconvinced.
Of course I'm ready, but not now, not this time for sure. I think it's not my war.
There are signs the call-up is more widespread than publicly promised, including an admonition by the country's top Orthodox priest for everyone to fulfill their military duty. But many seem to lack faith. In one clip posted online, the newly mobilized fight amongst themselves. In another, the drinking apparently begins far from the front. This recruiter tells his forcibly captive audience to be quiet and listen. They'll be shipped to training in 3 days and won't come back until the war is over. But others aren't waiting. The line at the Russia-Finland border is double what it was last week. Some Russians are driving away instead of being driven into Putin's war in Ukraine. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
Former President Donald Trump is back on the campaign trail, stumping for Republican candidates who will be on the ballot this November. Amna Nawaz has more.
Mr. Trump is in Wilmington, North Carolina today, holding a rally for Republican Congressman Ted Budd, who's running for the U.S. Senate. Our Lisa Desjardins is there and joins me now. Lisa, it's good to see you. We see those crowds there behind you, and I know you've been out talking to some of the attendees. So give us a sense of who's there, what brought them out, what are they telling you?
A very spirited crowd waiting under this Carolina blue sky for Mr. Trump, who is expected later in a short while. And I'll tell you, this crowd When you ask them why they're here, one of the first things they will tell you is because they love this country. The next thing they'll tell you, of course, is that they are devoted to former President Trump, and in fact, more devoted to him than to the Republican Party that he represents and leads. When you talk to folks here, you know that they expected a very large crowd, and indeed, this is not the stadium-sized draw that Mr. Trump had when he was running for president or was president, but it is still a few thousand people, one of the larger types of crowds that we will see in this midterm election cycle. We asked the people here why they support President Trump, what they make of the investigations underway, and what they think of how President Biden sees them.
He's calling us all extreme radicals, and we're not extreme. We just love our family. We love our country. We want what's best for it. And it's not fair to, I don't do that to Democrats. I don't group them all in one category. I don't. I have family and friends that are Democrats. They're just good people. We just think differently, but I don't call them names.
What we're going through here in Wilmington, North Carolina, the high gas prices, you know, the food prices, I just wonder sometimes how, you know, the poor people feed their children, clothe their children, send them to school. You know, I'm not happy with it at all. And I think Trump would make a lot of difference. He did, you know, back then. We weren't in the recession that we are in now.
How many times did they investigate the poor guy? I mean, for all that he accomplished while he was president, despite all the investigations and the headwinds against him, I mean, it's all ridiculous. If the guy did anything wrong, it would have come out by now.
I think what he has helped people like me do is get up off the chair and get involved and volunteer. And that's what I've done for the first time ever in my life. I'm 63.
For these midterm elections?
Yes, absolutely. Yep. I'm brand new to North Carolina, and I basically called up my local elections and said, hey, I want to be a poll watcher. And they said, okay, and they're making me a judge.
That's not haphazard politically. We know that Steve Bannon, former senior advisor and one of former President Trump's keenest allies, among others, has called for what he says is the precinct strategy for Trump allies to become election officials across the country. Here in North Carolina, Republicans and Democrats appoint judges on a local level. But this is something that Trump forces in particular want their people to do. So while that man I spoke to is doing it out of what he said was a personal sense of public service, it is part of a political strategy from former President Trump and his allies.
Lisa, you are, of course, in a key state for the battle of control for Congress. That's why Mr. Trump is there. But when you talk to his supporters, how motivated are they to turn out for a midterm election when he's not even on the ballot?
Such a great question. We have a 50-50 U.S. Senate right now. North Carolina is one of just 10 states that could determine whether Republicans or Democrats control that chamber going ahead. Now, let's talk about the race very quickly. Running for the North Carolina open Senate seat, vacated by Richard Burr, who's retiring, we have Representative Ted Budd, the Republican. Sherry Beasley is the Democrat. She's a former Chief Justice from the North Carolina Supreme Court. Both parties like their candidates here. President Trump has endorsed Ted Budd. That's one reason he was able to win the primary. Former President Trump, of course, I should say. But I want to point out why we're here, what this part of North Carolina. Talking to those involved in this race, Amna, this is a place where Joe Biden, running in 2020, underperformed. This was a place hard hit by COVID. The tourist economy here, beaches nearby, really felt COVID. And this is also a place where there are a lot of rural voters nearby that Republicans say they have to get out to win in November, and they're hard to reach door to door. So something like a rally from a former president is a way to reach thousands of them at a time.
Lisa, I heard you ask one of those attendees about some of the investigations, a lot of the headlines that we see at the national level about Mr. Trump. What did other people say when you asked them whether they care about the headlines this week of the New York Attorney General suing Mr. Trump for fraud or the ongoing Department of Justice investigation into his handling of classified materials down at his Florida estate? Does any of that matter to them?
I'd say there are two schools of thought on that, Amna. For some of these Trump voters here, they're enraged about it. They're actually motivated to get out because they believe those investigations are political, as the former president has alleged. For others who we spoke to, they said, I just want to move on. They'll say, I'm not a perfect person. I don't think former President Trump is a perfect person. If they were going to charge him, they should have done so previously. Of course, we know the legal problems. We know why that hasn't happened. But for those here, some of the folks just want to move on. I will say something that is universal in every person we've talked to at this rally. None of them believe that the results of the 2020 election are legitimate. They doubt it to different degrees, but none of them accept, as we know, it is legitimate, the election of Joe Biden. There is still conspiracy here, and the fraudulent idea that there were problems with that election. That is a very large part of this crowd.
Lisa, speaking of conspiracy theories, too, there was a previous Trump rally in Ohio that got a lot of attention because of the presence of QAnon supporters, the supporters of that extremist conspiracy theory. Are you seeing any signs of that in Wilmington tonight?
Yeah, we have been asking about that here. And most of the voters we talked to disavow QAnon, have rejected it, say they've looked into it. But I did speak to a woman who said she believes there is something to the QAnon conspiracy theories, and she likes that she believes President Trump is promoting them. We also saw QAnon bumper stickers in the parking lot. It is a dark conspiracy theory that is part of this crowd. But it sort of speaks to what this event is, really, Amna. It is an example of the contradictions in American politics right now. A crowd that comes here really talking about how much they love this country, but throughout this crowd are woven conspiracy ideas, you know, and even the idea of rejecting an election that we know was legitimate.
That is our Lisa Desjardins in Wilmington, North Carolina tonight, where former President Trump will be holding a rally. Lisa, thank you. Good to see you. For more on the former president and what appears to be his more overt embrace of QAnon, we turn to Mike Rothschild, author of the book The Storm Is Upon Us, How QAnon Became a Movement, Cult, and Conspiracy Theory of Everything. Mike Rothschild, welcome to the NewsHour. Thanks for joining us. So that overt embrace that some people say that they're seeing at these Trump rallies, what do you see? When you look at the rallies, from the messaging to the merchandise, is it a more overt embrace of this dangerous conspiracy theory?
What I'm seeing at the Trump rallies is absolutely a more overt embrace of QAnon. It looks almost like a church service with the swaying and the music and the two-way worship. This is a former president who is facing some real jeopardy. His back is really against the wall. And when your back is against the wall, you turn to the people who have always been in your corner. And for Trump, this is the QAnon movement. These are people who have stuck with him through everything that's happened. Every loss has just reaffirmed their faith in his greatness and his eventual victory. So when Trump looks at the QAnon movement, he sees a group of people who look at him as an almost messianic figure, and he is reflecting back to them the love that he's been given by them.
There's been a lot of headlines, a lot of attention to pay to some of these elements. There's a song in particular that seems to be associated with people who follow QAnon, and Trump actually has used it in a video. It's also been played at rallies like this one last weekend in Ohio. Just take a quick listen.
We are a nation that has weaponized its law enforcement against the opposing political party like never, ever before. We've got a federal bureau of investigation that won't allow bad election-changing facts to be presented to the public.
Now, Mike, the Trump team says this has nothing to do with QAnon, the music, but tell me what you're seeing online. How is this music being perceived and received by people who believe in this conspiracy theory?
So it's important to understand that there are really two songs going on here. The first is the piece that the Trump campaign says they've been using. It's a royalty-free piece called Mirrors. The second song is by this Richard Feelgood person, and it's called WWG1GA, which stands for Where We Go One, We Go All. It's the key QAnon catchphrase. Now, the Trump campaign says they're using Mirrors. They're not using the QAnon song. The QAnon people say, well, this is our song. It's got its title. This is him acknowledging us. It's him, you know, patting us on the head and telling us we're doing a great job and he's on our team and we're all going to win together. What this really is it's that messianic stance. It's them looking at him as this savior figure and Trump looking at them and saying, well, these people love me. I'm going to give it back to them. So it's a two-way relationship of everybody kind of patting each other on the back and giving each other the thumbs up and saying, hey, we're going to win this thing together. And the rest of us are just trying to figure out what is really going on here.
You know, we have to underscore here, we are talking about a baseless and dangerous conspiracy theory, one that fueled the January 6th insurrection, one that the FBI and Department of Homeland Security have issued warnings about because of potential violence from members. So help us understand why this overt embrace now. I mean, are we talking about a significant and powerful voting bloc here?
I think it's important to separate actual Q believers from the mass of Republicans. You know, Q is a very specific thing. It has its own branding, its own iconography. And a lot of Republicans, even a lot of very Trump-devoted Republicans, will say, I'm not one of those Q people. I don't believe in that stuff. That's not me. But they believe in all the same things. They believe the election was stolen. They believe that violence might be necessary to get Trump back in office. They believe the pandemic was a hoax. It's all the same thing. So ultimately, the branding and the iconography of QAnon doesn't mean as much as it used to, because this is a movement that has very violent tenets. It's based on a bedrock of mass arrests and executions, and it's being embraced by the mainstream Republican Party, even if they've dropped some of that branding and some of those catchphrases. So these people have really embraced what QAnon stands for, even if they haven't directly embraced QAnon.
So, Mike, when you have someone with the power and platform of former President Trump overtly embracing this conspiracy theory, now there's a lot of talk about what can be done about it. How do you respond to it? How should journalists cover it? How can companies and authorities and officials respond to it? What do you say to that?
Well, we have to take it seriously. You know, this is a movement that revolves around violence, and it's not the kind of thing that a former president or any real elected official would embrace. You know, they would want nothing to do with this. These would be the crazy people. You know, we don't talk about that. The president has now thrown his hat in with a very violent fringe group, and it has to be taken seriously. It has to be respected. We can't just write it off as some crazy internet stuff. This is now mainstream politics. This is the leader of the Republican Party, the presumptive nominee for 2024.
That is Mike Rothschild, author of the book, The Storm Is Upon Us, How QAnon Became a Movement, Cult, and Conspiracy Theory of Everything. Mike, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
President Biden rebuked Russia and Vladimir Putin in notable remarks at the United Nations General Assembly this week, all while investigations around former President Donald Trump picked up steam. To help us break down all this news and more, we turn to the analysis of Brooks and Tumulty. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Karen Tumulty, columnist for The Washington Post. Jonathan Capehart is away. Hello to both of you. Welcome to Karen and to David. So I want to start with Ukraine. What we've seen this week, major setbacks on the battlefield for Russia. Vladimir Putin, David, is responding by calling up hundreds of thousands of young and not so young reservists. He is orchestrating this sham election so that they can annex parts of Ukraine right now in the east. He is not backing down. He's doubling down. In fact, is there more? What more can the West, can the United States do at this point?
Yeah, well, you know, he is suffering all these setbacks on the ground and even a little at home. And what he's done, he's like a wounded tiger who's reacted by saying time is running out, time to attack. And so he's escalating. And so what the U.S. government is trying to do is to try to help the Ukrainians, push them out of Ukraine, but slowly so you don't trigger a nuclear war. And that's just a very fine line to walk through. And I think the government, the U.S. government, is doing what it has been doing and has plans to do a little more, which is to supply the Ukrainians with the weapons they need to win the war in Ukraine, not supply the weapons they might use to attack Moscow, but to keep giving them what they're doing, which is they've given them awesome amounts of intelligence so the Ukrainians really see the battlefield better. And they have the anti-aircraft material, they have anti-tank material, they have missile material. And so they're better trained, more morale, and they're just going to keep on plodding along. But it's that pacing that's so key, is to not get Putin where he feels like he's totally in a panic, and he escalates in a way that could involve attacking another country, attacking a NATO country, and a whole variety of ways he could escalate.
so much, Karen, of what you read is that it all depends on Vladimir Putin and what he decides and whether he wants to end this. I mean, is that how we should see it?
I think so. And we also should look beyond that, because it's important to remember China is watching here as well. And so they will be looking at Western resolve in the face of a nuclear threat, and as they try and decide what they're doing with Taiwan. But I do think the main thing the West has to do is stand firm, continue supplying aid. Europe, it's incumbent on Europe to come up with alternative supplies of fuel to get them through the winter as Russia cuts back, because that is where Vladimir Putin also has leverage. He has economic leverage.
And I think the Europeans, they've done a pretty good job of building up their stockpiles. They've done a pretty good job of passing serious measures so it won't hit people as hard as it might otherwise. And I think Putin has done everything possible to make it easier for NATO to stay together. And so even the speech this week, the mass graves, giving the Europeans months warning that he was going to cut off fuel before winter set in, he's hardened resolve around the world and kept what was going to be a tricky job of keeping the allies together. He's made it a little easier.
And it also is looking like his biggest problem may be domestically, as thousands of people are going to the street and protest, risking arrest. In fact, 1,300 have been arrested. People are fleeing for the border to, men who are in threat, the 300,000 being drafted. He's got some big problems at home, too.
But you do get the sense. I mean, we mentioned President Biden's speech at the UN General Assembly. You have other countries that are contributing to the war effort in Ukraine. But you also get the effort that there's just a limit to how much push this can, how much difference all this can make.
The hope is that at some point, the weather in Ukraine makes it harder to do mass offensive the later you get into the fall, because it gets muddy. And so there's going to be some time here. And so the hope is that at some point Putin says, hey, let's do a cost-benefit analysis. I need to do some negotiation. And then the hope is that the Ukrainians say, we've done fantastic, but actually pushing Russian troops out of the Donbas and the eastern regions is actually kind of hard, and maybe we should go to the negotiating table. And so that would be one out where they would just negotiate a solution. I think, and I don't blame the Ukrainians, they're the heroes here, but they're passions are high. They're filled with indignation. They're at least talking in a very maximalist way. We want Crimea back. We want reparations. And so maybe the Ukrainians will just, it's their war. And maybe they'll just keep pushing maybe a little faster than some of the allies would like or supporters would like.
So let's turn to politics in this country. As we saw in the report before this, Karen, midterms are getting closer. And today, the House Republicans and the minority leader, Kevin McCarthy, made a speech, went out of his way to sort of outline what he sees as what the Republican agenda would be if they take the majority in the fall. But we want to show just a quick clip of some of what he said and some of how President Biden responded. Here it is.
We want an economy that is strong. That means you can fill up your tank. You can buy the groceries. You have enough money left over to go to Disneyland and save for a future. That the paychecks grow, they no longer shrink. We have a plan for a nation that's safe. That means your community will be protected. Your law enforcement will be respected. Your criminals will be prosecuted.
The House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, went to Pennsylvania and unveiled on what he calls a commitment to America. That's a thin series of policy goals with little or no detail. Here's a few of the things we didn't hear. We didn't hear him mention the right to choose. We didn't hear him mention Medicare. We didn't hear him mention Social Security.
So, Karen, what's going on here?
Well, normally a midterm election is a referendum on the president, but this one's different because people are looking at what the Republican agenda itself could be, in part because of the abortion decision, in part because Donald Trump is in the news constantly. And so, yes, the House Republicans are looking for something to talk about that are not those two things. But this package that was unveiled today and was meant to be sort of an echo of the 1994 contract with America was not specific at all. It was basically a bunch of talking points. And I think that, among other things, reflects how fractured the Republicans in the House are. I mean, getting a majority of them to agree on anything is not only difficult in the campaign, but it is going to be difficult for Kevin McCarthy or whoever the speaker is, if in fact the Republicans get power, get the majority again in this midterm election.
How fractured are they, and how detailed do they have to
get? Well, in 2020, they had no platform at all, so I take this as a step forward.
They did. Their platform was anything Donald Trump wants.
Yeah, so, you know, the party's in this interesting transition from being, it used to be sort of a business party, and it's becoming a working class party. And so it's becoming a party that's much more hostile to corporations, much more welcoming of the entitlement state, the welfare state, Social Security, Medicare, and all that sort of thing. Much more willing to use government to help working class folks. But it takes a while for a party to migrate. I think they are migrating, but a lot of people like Kevin McCarthy are part of the old party. And there are some very fine people, Paul Ryan, the former speaker, he was part of the old party. And so within the House, you've got people part of that business party, and then you've got the working class party, and they don't see eye to eye a lot, because this is a party really changing its colors in rapid form.
And Karen, I mean, you look at this and you think, this is what we're going to watch for the next 7 or 8 weeks until the election.
I think this is what we're going to watch. But again, one of the problems for the Republicans is, again, Donald Trump keeps creeping back into the news.
And speaking of Donald Trump, this was, David, a tough week for him. There was not only a court ruling against his side and what to do with those papers that the FBI seized at his Mar-a-Lago estate. There's also this New York State Attorney General who is coming down with accusing him and his family and his business of fraud. And yet, as we just watched in Lisa Desjardins at that rally, he's drawing big crowds.
Yeah, the civil suit in New York amused me. I learned from Eugene Robinson, your colleague, that he claimed that his apartment in New York was 30,000 square feet when it's only 11,000 square feet. So that's like classic Donald Trump. It's not the most politically important of the investigations, because it'll take years to run through the courts. And even if he lost everything, then had to pay $250 million, his organization could afford it. The Georgia case is more serious, and then the Mar-a-Lago case are more serious. And the judicial decision in the Mar-a-Lago case seems plain common sense, and it was two out of the three judges who made it were Trump appointees, which says if we're going to investigate the documents, then the investigators have to see the documents. That doesn't seem like a very complicated legal thing, and so it means the investigation into those documents will speed up.
So, Karen, how does this bad news affect Donald Trump's prospects and his ability to sway the results?
Well, we know what the
playbook
is, because we've seen Donald Trump in legal trouble so many times. It's delay, deflect, bluster, play the victim, and counterattack. But what does feel different now is this accumulation of legal problems, not only being accused of $250 million worth of fraud in New York and having the Fulton County, Georgia DA trying to figure out what kind of pressure he was putting on local officials to swing the election, but you've got the January 7th committee, you've got the Justice Department looking into Trump's actions before that, and, you know, the fact that he had classified documents in his personal possession at Mar-a-Lago. It's just so many things going on at once.
All at once, David, and yet he's drawing big crowds. I'm to repeat myself.
I mean,
his believers still believe, and according to Lisa's reporting, everyone she talked to said they still think that election was stolen.
Yeah, and they think these investigations are politically motivated, which is not 100% wrong, by the way. But, you know, there might be some, and not people who would show up at a Trump rally. But I ran into a guy, conversation last week or so, a big Trump supporter, really likes Donald Trump, but is supporting Ron DeSantis for the nomination, not because he has anything against Trump, he just thinks we should nominate a guy without baggage. It's just going to be easier to get him to win. And so if there are enough Republicans who make that calculation, then some non-Trump person would have a chance. I still wouldn't bet on it, but there must be a significant number of people who would. And I thought before the Mar-a-Lago search, you saw real evidence of Republicans drifting away from Trump. Now they've drifted back. Will they drift away again? Time will tell.
And the other big question, Arthur Karen, is how much influence will he have on these races where he's endorsed a candidate if his own, if the luster is coming off some of Donald Trump himself?
He's certainly, within a Republican primary, you know, his word is almost everything. But as a result, there are a lot of very weak Republican candidates running, particularly for the Senate.
Well, we are going to leave it there. Karen Tumulty, welcome to the table tonight. David Brooks, thank you both.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Tuesday night saw a rare celebration of our nation's public servants. The Samuel J. Heyman Service to America Medals, or SAMMEs, are given out each year to a wide array of government workers across many agencies. This year's winners come from all corners of government, from an education specialist to the State Department team that coordinated the largest resettlement of refugees in modern U.S. history. NASA's Greg Robinson walked home with the flagship award, Federal Employee of the Year, for his role managing the construction and implementation of the Webb Telescope, the most advanced in space, now sending back those spectacular images of our solar system and beyond. I sat down with him right before the ceremony to talk about his work. Gregory Robinson, welcome to the NewsHour. Congratulations.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here.
So what did you think when you found out that you are the Federal Employee of the Year?
It's humbling, I must say. And when I look at all of the stories of other finalists, there's amazing work going on across government. Some surprising, some not, but just a lot of great work.
So you were with the federal government. You've now retired, but you were with the government for decades. Take us back to 2018. There you were at NASA. You were Deputy Associate Administrator for Programs. You were overseeing performance, I read, of over 100 programs. And then your boss came to you and said, we want you to run the Webb Telescope program. What did you think?
Well, I tried to run as well, but he wouldn't let me go. I really enjoyed the job I was doing. I was having fun with it. I thought I was making a difference. I think I was. So I really loved what I was doing. So I did not want to take the Webb job. So I declined a couple of times. And over, I don't know, 2-3 weeks, he finally convinced me to take it. And
they doubled your salary? I mean, why did you agree?
Government. We just talked about that. He just made a convincing case on how important Webb is. To NASA and really to the world, and we really needed to get it over the goal line. So after reluctance and a lot of time talking with my wife and a few mentors, I agreed to take it on.
The program was described at that time, and this was 4 years ago, as having a lot of problems, being off track, delays, really shot through with problems in a way. What did you do, Greg Robinson, to turn that around?
So for these major projects, we call them flagship missions, they're very bold. I mean, we're doing things that have never been done before. Some of the things I did, one was making sure everyone was aligned from the lowest person on the team all the way up through NASA headquarters, through the administrator, and our stakeholders in OMB and Congress. Just making sure everyone was looking at things the right way, asking the right questions, and responding appropriately. That was one piece. The other one was allowing fresh eyes to come in. There are other smart people within and outside the agency who were not working on Webb. And sometimes having those people come in and help you out a little bit is important. And we got some benefit out of that as well.
You are very aware, I know, that federal employees are often invisible. They've frankly not been given a lot of credit over the years. You've heard politicians talk about bureaucrats, lazy, just taking up space, wasting taxpayer dollars. What should the public know about the people you worked with at NASA when you were there?
You hear the saying in NASA all the time that it's all about the mission, and it really is. People get up in the morning and their job is to get that thing done, and that's how they operate. And even though we went through challenges, No one ever tucked their tail and ran. They met every challenge, got it done. So an amazing workforce.
I think it goes without saying, Greg Robinson, that you're one of the very few black men working at a high level at NASA, and you could say that across the federal government. To what extent has race been an issue for you in your career?
There are times I've felt resistance to advancement, and certainly to lead certain different parts of the organization, what I call the major parts, and certainly major flight programs or flight projects. I had some of that and over the years, but I can honestly say I believe mine has been a lot less than others, not to make it better, because it's still not a good thing. And doing a program with Howard University, one of my alma maters, a year and a half ago, and the question came up, are you the first African-American to lead a major program at NASA? And I had my comms team with me, and no one can answer the question. When you can't answer that question, I've been around NASA 33 years, I think you got the answer, right? So I think that's something we really need to work on. I shouldn't be the first one. Hopefully, and I've had this conversation with others, in 5 years, Greg Robinson will just be a common name leading programs around NASA.
Your parents were sharecroppers, tobacco sharecroppers in Southern Virginia. You're one of, what, 11 children? Your parents are no longer alive. What do you think they would be saying if they were here today about you?
They say, what the hell is this boy doing up there? That's probably what they would say. They would be proud of me, no doubt about it. We worked hard coming up. Certainly, they worked extremely hard to try to get us educated, just to try to raise us. Times were tough. I started out in segregated Virginia, Southern Virginia in particular, through grades 4. And segregation has its own, even after it's desegregated, its own challenges as far as opportunity and exposure and things like that. So they would be quite proud of where I've ended up.
There's a good reason for that. And we want to add our congratulations. Federal Employee of the Year, Partnership for Public Service, Greg Robinson, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Outdoor enthusiasts know well the physical and restorative benefits of spending a beautiful day in the woods on a trail. But for many people, there are a lot of barriers, even to taking a simple hike because of a disability or difficulty with balance. As Jennifer Rooks of Maine Public Television reports, a new grassroots movement aims to change that and make trails accessible to all.
In Yarmouth, Maine, just a little north of Portland, volunteers are nearly finished building the 11-mile multi-use West Side Trail. The final mile, this section, will be accessible to those with disabilities.
The boards are my favorite part, carrying them.
Owen Seehagen and his sister Olivia are first-time volunteers here with their grandfather.
We're building a bridge for the people that have a wheelchair or need help walking.
This one I tried chamfering. I want to see how that works out.
Engineering and design details matter. There can be no wide gaps between the boards. And the team has chosen cedar that is rough sawn because it's less slippery than pressure-treated lumber. On the graveled sections of the path, the grades and turns are gentle.
The new section of the West Side Trail is one of a handful of new trail projects around the state designed to be universally accessible. They're part of a growing national movement known as Outdoors for All. But one of the biggest proponents of that movement here in Maine isn't waiting for special new trails to be built. He's out there now.
Meet Enoch Glidden. Born with spina bifida, Glidden goes everywhere in a wheelchair. For a year now, he's been traveling all over Maine, testing trails for the app Maine Trail Finder. Today, it's the Knights Pond Preserve in Cumberland, Maine.
When I'm doing these trails, I'm taking note in my head of different obstacles, like there's a hill behind us, or rocks coming up the hill, or grooves in the road or roots. That's a big thing. There's lots of roots usually because of trees. And so I take note of all those things in my mind, and I take pictures and I take video.
When he gets home, he posts his picture and writes a blog. He liked this trail and rated most of it accessible or, quote, wheelie easy. His message, it might not take much to make your trails significantly more accessible.
If people would just look at the trails they already have, the easy ones, and look at it from a perspective of, if I was in a chair right now, would any of this stop me from continuing? They do find something that would stop them. How can we fix it? And then just fix that. And fix the next thing and the next thing. And then pretty soon you have an accessible trail.
The origin story of the organization is amazing.
Zach Stegeman of the Adaptive Outdoor Education Center says outdoors for all means all ages and all abilities.
I think we are approaching a tipping point, approaching a movement.
How far do we have to go?
As far as the trail goes. We've got a long ways to go. It doesn't have to be every trail, but it sure would be great if we looked at just about every venue with trails having one that is accessible, where someone with a physical challenge navigating some uneven terrain, or perhaps a traumatic brain injury and some balance issues, could be visually impaired, whatever the challenge is, that they can still get outside, access that beautiful space. It doesn't have to be the summit. It can just be somewhere along the way.
Meantime, the volunteers in West Yarmouth will keep showing up.
It's incredibly good work, and it will result in a very good product used by hundreds and hundreds of people for decades. So what's not to like?
And Enoch Glidden will keep trying new trails, inspired by the people he's helping.
A lady walked up to me and said, "Aren't you Enoch Glidden?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I love your blogs. You've pointed out so many places that me and my mother can go together." And so that's really why I do that.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jennifer Rooks in Cumberland, Maine.
Hilary Mantel authored 17 books, but it was her trilogy of historical fiction based on the life of England's Thomas Cromwell and King Henry VIII that brought her worldwide fame and acclaim. Mantel died yesterday at age 70 of a stroke at a hospital near her home in Exeter, England. The NewsHour's Jeffrey Brown sat down with Mantel in 2015. At the time, she had published the first two novels of the trilogy, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. The former was being adapted for both a PBS television series and for the Broadway stage. Here's an excerpt of their conversation. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Hilary Mantel and her historic characters are seemingly everywhere.
The ever-expanding Henry VIII, yes. With his six literally wives. No one else has a ruler with six wives who cuts the heads off two of them. So you're off to a flying start there.
Mantel's novels, Wolf Hall and its sequel, Bring Up the Bodies, have been an international sensation, with more than 4 million books sold in 37 languages. She won the prestigious Man Booker Prize twice, a first for a woman.
We meet up with our fellow guildsmen.
It's a familiar story in many ways, the momentous reign in the 1500s of the Tudor King Henry, played on television by Damian Lewis.
A king should show himself sometimes, don't you think?
Basking in power but needing a male heir, cutting loose one wife in favor of the young Anne Boleyn, only to cut her head off when no son is produced. But Hilary Mantel has told the story in a new way, giving the lead role to Thomas Cromwell, played by Mark Rylance.
What did you just do?
I hit Mark Smeaton, only with one finger.
Cromwell has long been cast as the Heavy, a shadowy, cruel schemer, especially as compared to his great rival, Thomas More. Mantel's Cromwell is certainly clever and scheming, but he's also charming and urbane.
Thomas Cromwell, son of a blacksmith, who rose to be the king's right-hand man and eventually Earl of Essex, My question is simple. How do you do that? What kind of a man in that hierarchical, structured society can break through all the social layers, all the factors stacked against him, and climb so high? And what is the price?
You looked at the history and you said, this is wrong, the way he's been portrayed?
I thought it was a lot more complicated and nuanced than the popular picture of Cromwell. I wanted to put the spotlight on him. And I wanted to ask my reader or our audience, well, what would you do if you were him? Just walk a mile in his shoes and then see what you think.
Mantell says she grounded her fiction in years of research.
I think that an imaginative writer for stage or novel has still has a responsibility to their reader, and that responsibility is to get the history right.
You want to do that?
Absolutely. That's the absolute foundation of what I do. I begin to imagine at the point where the facts run out. But like a historian, I'm working on the great marshy ground of interpretation.
Which historians do, but also you're saying novelists.
Exactly. We all share the same sources. We share the same facts. The question is, where do we stand to view them? I sometimes think back, though, to the day when I began, because it's very vivid in my mind, writing the first paragraph and having that feeling by the time I was halfway down the first page, this is the best thing you've ever done. I was walking around with a big grin. Do you want to see my first page?
From that first page to the very last one, Hilary Mantel completed her famed trilogy in 2020 with the novel The Mirror and the Light. And now, something we have to share. One of our viewers let us know that her son, Benjamin, is a big fan of the NewsHour, especially our theme music. He gets very excited when it comes on the TV. So at her request, we sent Benjamin a little gift, a clip of our music, and his mom programmed it into one of his toys. Bum-bum-ba. It doesn't get any better than that. Thank you, Benjamin. He's just 18 months old. His mother says he's been watching for a long time. He reminds us how grateful we are for fans of all ages. Thank you. And on to this evening. Join moderator Yamiche Alcindor and her panel on tonight's Washington Week here on PBS. And tomorrow on PBS News Weekend, we get the latest on the ground in Puerto Rico as the island works to recover from Hurricane Fiona. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.